Welcome listeners and viewers to a special edition of Office 365 Exposed, your one-stop shop for everything that you ever wanted to know about Ignite and about Office 365.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome, Tony.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be with you again.
I'm glad to see you again. You know, normally we record these every so often when we happen to be in the same city, and Ignite is always a good opportunity to get together.
It's tremendous to be here, though. We're surrounded by technology and everything.
Well, this also, you know, Atlanta has given the world so many things. It's famous for its Civil War history. Chick-fil-A was founded here. The Waffle House was founded here. I mean, it's a wonderful place.
Certainly is. Anyway, let's talk a little bit more.
Right, let's get right to it. We have a lot to talk about today.
Yeah, and we time is limited. What do you think of the event so far? I mean, the logistics working better than Chicago?
I think Chicago was the low point of Microsoft conferences. Of all the conferences I've ever been to, it was the least well-organized. It had the most logistical difficulties. The food was terrible. There was an awful lot of attendee complaining.
Yeah.
Here, by contrast, everybody generally seems happy. I've heard a few isolated gripes about small aspects. For example, there are some folks who say they don't like box lunches. Well,
yep.
The box lunches were a reaction to people saying they didn't have enough time to eat and still make it to sessions. Hmm. On balance, though, everybody seems very happy with it. I'm delighted with my experience so far.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I think that we've seen some crowding at escalators and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's natural.
And certainly, I don't think the room scheduling has worked out quite as effectively as people liked. For instance, yesterday during the grand debate.
Yes, the debate with you and Mr. Taylor.
Yeah, the grand debate whether or not people should bring their mailboxes into the cloud or stay on premises. We had a room, I think it was about 550 in the room, but there were about 150 people outside, which seems terrible in one way because people are paying $2,200 to come to this conference,
right.
and that's just not the kind of experience that you want.
So if you think about sort of the remote viewing experience, Microsoft has come a long way since Ignite last year.
Yep.
There's a hangout area where you can stand and watch the slides for multiple presentations at once. They're rebroadcasting audio in set locations around the conference hall. There's live streaming. It raises a question: if you're going to just watch a live stream on your computer, do you really need to invest the time and effort to come here? But I think the community aspect of this conference is
definitely
is
the opportunity
well worth it.
To talk to people and whatever, and also to actually get to interact with the folks who are actually doing the presentations.
Yes,
I see an awful lot. But let's talk about some of the news that's been happening. Talk a little bit about SharePoint. SharePoint is.
Do we have to?
Yes, we
sorry,
have.
Sorry, SharePoint people.
Sure,
I love. Yeah, okay,
no, no.
I'm sorry.
I mean, to be fair to Microsoft, they've really, really accelerated progress with SharePoint recently, and some good stuff. Nice people card appeared, so that you see all of the details of the work that somebody has done inside a site. Now, very Delve-like. I think they borrowed some UI hints from that, which I liked a lot. But I know that you were taken by some of the work that they've been doing with the OneDrive client, the Sync client.
Well, so one other thing I wanted to say, you just mentioning Delve sparked that, of course. It's not called Delve Analytics anymore. Now it's My Analytics.
Yes.
I thought we had done away with the whole My thing when we got rid of the My Computer icon, but
no,
I guess
well,
not.
So here's the deal. Here's the deal. And we will come back to SharePoint in a little while. I talked to the analytics guys about this, and I said to them, so why have you renamed it? And they said it's because everybody was confusing Delve with Delve Analytics. And there is no real link.
Right.
So they actually found it difficult to create a value case to communicate to customers. So they said, OK, what we're going to do now is gradually going to expand the scope of analytics. But as we expand the growth of analytics and what they cover, it's going to become further and further away from Delve.
That makes sense.
So you're probably going to see this, I think, evolve into a separate app into its own right. For what it's worth.
I had another theory, which was that they used My just to help people feel more comfortable that it's their data and it's reporting on only their own scope. But
yeah, there is something in that, but privacy is really, really, really important. But another thing is that it's positioning, because there is also going to be workplace analytics.
Right.
Right. Now, workplace analytics is not the kind of analytics that any one user would want to have. This is something that an operations analyst or a HR analyst would want to get involved in. And it's really only suitable for the very large scale enterprises where you've got 25, 50,000 users. And you want to see, can you actually make something more effective? Can you make meetings more effective? Can you make email communications more effective? Can you make personal communications more effective?
Right.
And you need that broad amount of data. And this is what Microsoft is going to bring to market. They're talking about it here at Ignite for the first time. And they're saying that this is something that is going to be probably delivered in conjunction with service partners, something like a Bain Consulting
or one
of those type of big consulting houses. And they'd be able to sit down with a HR consultant or an operations consultant and figure out, you know, well, if we look at, let's say, all the managers in the organization,
right. What
makes a difference? What characteristics can we measure across the organization to identify effective managers versus ineffective managers?
That's going to be fun.
That's going to be fun. And you know, I think this is going to be an offering that is going to be very, very good for America and the U.S. market, because it's the kind of thing that's well accepted here.
Yes.
But in Europe and other parts of the world, this might not go over so well. But it's kind of interesting. In fact, I was talking there to some of the Delve Analytics guys, or my analytics, or the analytics team, and they said that one of the learnings that they have accumulated over the last year or so in just working with customers around my analytics is that by making very small changes, they can really impact the effectiveness of an organization quite a lot. Here's one that they told me. A lot of organizations just allow recurring meetings to keep on recurring, and they never, ever, ever, ever ask, why is that meeting in the calendar?
Okay, that's
and
fair.
Why do we need to keep on having it? They found that by having a simple rule, the simple rule is this, that every recurring meeting has to be reestablished, has to be cleared off the calendar and reestablished once a year. And it all happens at a particular point in the year. You say, 1st of February, all recurring meetings deleted. And if people want them, they have to go and reestablish. Said that frees up an average 30% of the time spent on recurring meetings in an organization over a year. A simple thing like that. Another simple thing that they found, another simple tip that they gave me, which, you know, simplicity is great because it makes it so easy to implement them. Cutting a meeting length from 1 hour to 30 minutes will dramatically change the type of meetings, the focus of meetings, and also give you back the average worker probably back 4 hours a week.
So I believe that that's true, but I would also argue that that only works if you have people who are disciplined enough to conduct the meeting business in that time frame.
Oh, yeah. You have but to have some rules. And one of the rules that tends to be put in is that you have 10 minutes to state a case, 10 minutes to argue it, and 10 minutes to Q&A. So it's a 10-10-10 rule.
Right.
And people have been using that for years and years and years. But it's kind of interesting when you have the data to back it up. You can all of a sudden start, you get a different insight, you get a different view of how effective those simple changes are.
Well, speaking of being effective, let's get back to talking about
SharePoint
and about OneDrive.
Okay, the OneDrive, especially the OneDrive for Sync client.
So you might remember, a very long time ago, I wrote a book on Exchange 2003. And
I was
a very early user of the Groove technology that Microsoft acquired when they bought Rayazi and his company, and that still lingers today with the groove.exe executable we're all familiar with.
Yep.
So for a very long time I've been a big fan of that kind of file synchronization. But Microsoft has had a hard time delivering on that promise. They've had a lot of bumps in the road with the sync client, its performance, its behavior, its consistency, and so on. I really feel like they're turning the corner on that, and I'm excited to see now that the sync client will support synchronizing SharePoint document libraries again on Windows.
Yeah. I couldn't actually understand why the Groove client had so many problems with SharePoint, because SharePoint is not new. It's been around a long time.
I never understood that either, and when I would talk to SharePoint people about it, they would try to explain, but because I'm not a SharePoint person, you know, it didn't really sink in. But
yeah, but it's at least they've solved it now. Well, they say they solved it now. They're going to have a preview release of the new sync client as opposed to the old sync client, and the new sync client will be able to synchronize SharePoint libraries, including those used by Office 365 groups.
Yes. I'm very excited about that. And in general, you know, I'm excited to see that team is making progress. They're having regular previews.
Yep.
They're rolling out features across their mobile clients. So, for example, we got the new file activity view in the iOS client.
Yes.
That shows you what essentially the revision history or the audit history of a file is, and that's tremendously useful. So they're continuing to drive not just the big features like document library sync, but also small ones on a regular, steady
cadence.
Love it.
So speaking of groups, there were a lot of announcements about groups this week.
Yes, there were.
I'm sure you were very, very excited about the link up between Group and Yammer. Hold back that excitement there. I can see it in your face.
I will hold that excitement.
Well, so the important thing here to remember is that the implementation of the Groups link up with Yammer is really, it's just for new Yammer groups. There's no retrofitting on top of existing Office 365 groups or existing Yammer groups. And the sole purpose in mind to me is that this now allows those new Yammer groups to have access to SharePoint.
I would agree.
And the group calendar. So they get a little bit of exchange. But essentially what Microsoft is now saying is that, look, you have to make a decision within your organization about the style of collaboration you have. You're either email style collaboration, in which case you use the Office 365 groups as they are right now, or you're more type of web style discussions, which is what Yammer is all about.
Right.
Grand scale, massive scale discussions, ideas for everybody kind of thing. If you like that kind of thing, then you can now link those Yammer groups to Office 365 groups, and you get a form of Office 365 groups which don't let you have conversations in the group mailbox. But you do get the shared notebook, you get the ability to create a plan, you get access to the SharePoint library, and as I say, the calendar.
And it sounds like that will be useful, but my question is, doesn't that penalize the people that have been carrying the Yammer flag, the early adopters that already have large numbers of Yammer groups? Now, there's no route forward for them to integrate with 365 groups, or
there's
is
no
there?
Route forward at the moment, but
okay,
Microsoft,
that's fair.
Microsoft were careful enough to say, look, this is a phased release. And I think that's probably a very wise thing to do, because nobody wants to go in and say, well, I've got 50,000 Yammer groups, I'm going to have 50,000 new Office 365 groups. That would be hilariously, you know, the wrong end of the scale.
So
but if you had 5,000 or even 1,000, you don't want that kind of thing, because it would wreak devastation in your directory.
Yes.
So it's probably good for them to say, nope, it's for new groups now. And you have to make a decision, Mr. Customer. Which way do you want to do collaboration in the future?
When you say you have to make a decision, Mr. Customer, of course, that leads me to wonder, are there admin controls that let you allow or stop people from doing these things? I mean, that's been a persistent
complaint. Well, I have asked that question. Admin controls are a big hot button with me.
Yes.
I have asked the guys about this, and so far there's a deafening wall of silence.
All right, Microsoft, we want to know.
Yeah. I suspect that there isn't so many admin controls around. I would like, for example, an admin control at a tenant level to say what is the default form of collaboration.
Yes.
I would like admin control to say what features am I going to make available to a group. For example, I might say I don't want to do any sort of exchange at all, in which case I'm willing to accept that I'm not going to have a group calendar. But we don't know. Again, it's part of the phased rollout.
Okay, well, that's totally fair. Ignite is a time when Microsoft surfaces new features that maybe are not completely implemented. It's fair to do demos of things that are not ready yet. So I'll give them a pass
on
that for now.
We'll see. I mean, they're going to re-roll into that over the next while. They are implementing, though, soft delete for groups. Which
Finally.
Okay,
that's not entirely fair. It's a mandatory feature. You have to have it.
Yeah. Some people I've been speaking to here at Ignite have been really, really surprised that it's taken Microsoft almost 2 years to bring soft delete forward. Right? I mean, groups were introduced in November 2014.
Right.
So it's nearly 2 years. And so for the last 2 years, administrators and users and group owners have been making mistakes and deleting groups and finding out, oops, whoops, it's gone.
But we had nearly 20 years of having to do that with Active Directory before we got a recycle bin. So
that's true. And to be fair, it took Exchange a while as well before getting soft delete. But in talking to some of the guys that are involved in groups, they've been educating me about why it's so difficult. It's easy enough for Exchange if you just take Exchange, because Exchange allows you to recover deleted mailboxes, et cetera, et cetera. It's easy enough for SharePoint, because SharePoint has a recycle bin and you can always recover, provided you remember that you need to recover, I think within 14 days or whatever it is. But then there's all the other workloads that groups are associated with. Specifically, the keystone of this is Azure Active Directory. Because if you go and you blow away a group, you blow away that group object in Azure Active Directory, how do you get it back?
Right.
Okay? But then there's also Microsoft Planner, there's Dynamics CRM, there's Power BI, et cetera, et cetera. So in fact, I think they're actually pretty wise, because what they tell me that they've been doing is that they've been educating all of these different workloads as to how to be a good group citizen.
Good.
So that when a delete action occurs, it is a soft delete, and basically a signal goes out to all of these workloads to say, hey, guess what, guys? This group is going away, but we want you to keep it around for 14 days.
Makes sense.
Okay, and if you do delete it, okay, we should be able to recover in that period. And if we do recover, we're going to send you out another signal And you, individual workloads out there, you're going to be able to respond to that signal and recover. That's, as I understand it, will happen. Now, they've promised to deliver this for the end of 2016, and we'll wait and see. Another thing they've promised to deliver for 2016 is, the end of 2016, is policy-driven work cycle, or policy-driven life cycle. I don't know, I'm tired after a couple of days at Ignite.
Yes.
I'm just... But this is another interesting thing, because what they're saying now is that when groups get created, you as the administrator, you as the owner say, I think this group is going to last a certain period, let's say a couple of years.
Right.
And then when that time period elapses, you'll get an email and you'll be told, do you want to keep this group anymore? And you'll have to attest that you want to keep that group and keep it.
Because up until now, groups have represented sort of a mouse hole, if you will, where your records retention victims can escape. You can put documents into a group that are not monitored by or subject to the same retention and control policies that you have elsewhere.
Ah, be careful there, because the recent changes in the Security and Compliance Center have exposed groups fully.
But how recent?
Well, it's rolled out. It's in full production now.
That's my point. I mean,
yeah, it did take time. No, your point is well made. But we should also give Microsoft some credit here, but they have expanded the capabilities of content searches inside the Security and Compliance Center, and also e-discovery cases to actually now use both the group mailboxes and group document libraries as sources for those type of retention things. But you're right. I mean, it just takes time for this kind of policy stuff to come in.
Well, there's a lot to do. There's so many different pieces of Office 365 that getting all the ants marching in the same direction is a challenge sometimes.
Now you're a Mac guy a long time ago. You're still a Mac guy.
I'm afraid so.
You're part of the Apple ecosystem. Well, do you think it's important to have apps like Groups on the iPad?
You know, I have mixed feelings about that. I've never bought into the notion of the iPad as a productivity tool.
Really?
And
I see so many people on planes with iPads that
I do too, and it drives me crazy. I want to be able to have multiple applications with a window layout that I control.
Yeah.
I want to be able to easily move data between applications. I want to have full access to all my repository of files. Leaving aside that I want to run applications that don't have good iPad versions, I have a really hard time imagining, for example, that I would want to write a book chapter or a long technical document in Word on the iPad. It's a great tool. It works very well, and if you have a keyboard, it is, it's not awful, but it's not as good as Word 2016 on a full computer.
That's not the kind of scenario I think they're looking at.
No, I don't think it is either.
I think they're looking at the whole, it's much more conversations, the email conversations, rather than the documents. Documents might be for review, but conversations
is all about interaction. I think having some type of client that works properly on a broad spectrum of mobile devices is going to be critical for anything that Microsoft wants to launch into the 365 space.
Yep.
If you look at the Yammer mobile app, for example, I think you can make a good case that it was not quite up to snuff, and that harmed adoption of Yammer in some ways. I think if you look across a broad SaaS ecosystem, there are many other third-party services like Concur, the travel and expense management tool, that have in large part been successful because their mobile apps are good, and they make it easy for people to do whatever the app does on the fly.
Right.
So I think it's important that there be a mobile app. I don't know that I have strong feelings that it has to be an iPad-optimized, iPad-aware app as opposed to just a universal iOS app.
Again, talking to some of the guys who have been working in this space, they say that an iPhone-optimized app, and most apps out of the box are going to be optimized for the iPhone,
sure,
really doesn't stretch all that well for the iPad.
And I can see that that's true, but if you line up Apple's devices now and you look at the size of an iPad mini, versus a 6 plus or 7 plus.
Yes.
There is a size difference, but you're starting to get into
it. But isn't it in the width?
Well, it is, and the iPad Pro sort of ruins that argument because it's so much bigger than the standard iPad or the iPad Mini. And so just like we had to do with Windows, Windows app developers had to learn to adjust to different DPI levels and different the presence of multiple monitors and so on.
Yep.
And we're seeing that in the iOS world too. You have to learn to take advantage of however much screen real estate you've got.
Yeah, and it's worth also saying that while the iOS apps are very important for Office 365, including Groups, that they're also available for Android and for Windows Phone, for which I am eternally grateful. Thank you very much, Microsoft, for supporting your own platform for at least the next year or so.
Ouch.
Sorry. Yeah, I know. Well, you know, you buy a Windows phone and what happens? Anyway, am I bitter? No, not at all. Anyway, on a positive note, the other thing about Office 365 groups was, of course, that Microsoft seems to be using them as a cornerstone for the announced link up with Workday, but we'll have to see how that happens. I haven't quite got my head around that and say how data from Workday HR applications are going to flow in such a way.
I'm not sure that I understand that well. I try generally to stay away from anything that has HR in it, and that's been a good strategy for me so far, so I think I'll stick with it.
Yeah. So you use Outlook Mobile?
I do, heavily. I love it.
Okay, you love it. I actually don't like it as much as I like the Outlook on the Windows Phone.
Neither do I. I prefer the Windows Phone.
So why do you? But you love Outlook Mobile. That's like a very strange situation to be in.
When you consider the alternatives, particularly on iOS, Apple's native clients are great if you're stuck in IMAP land.
Right.
Or maybe I don't use Gmail, so I can't really have an opinion about how good they are with Gmail. I've heard some people say they like them, some people say they don't. But I like having the rich feature set that Microsoft has put into Outlook Mobile and that they continue to build on. So for example, I can go to my calendar. If I have a Skype meeting there will be a join button that when I tap it takes me directly to the meeting with a single click.
Right.
Now of course, in fairness, that was a Windows Mobile feature some time ago.
Right.
But leaving that aside, you know, there are many other reasons why you might pick Android or iOS over Windows Phone. Or Windows Mobile, or whatever we're calling it these days.
But they made some changes this week, didn't they?
They did.
Yeah, so what do you think of those? What are
they? Shared calendar support is probably the big one. Right. And the reason I say that is that shared calendars in some respects are like public folders. If they're important to you, they're very important to you. Mm. But if you don't use them, you wouldn't care. Mm. What we see for shared calendars is people use them primarily for team collaboration scenarios, but also for boss admin scenarios.
Yep.
And I don't have any data to back this up, but my sort of gut feel is that the people who are going to benefit from this the most are going to be, you know, Carl Calendar, the guy whose job it is to manage the calendars of 6 or 7 executives that he works for. Now he's going to be able to do that on mobile.
Yeah.
He'll be able to do that in a meeting, walking
between
meetings
with his
boss.
I hope he'd be doing it on a device with a big screen, because I can't imagine it doing it on a little bitty device.
If he has the ability to do that, but sometimes, as you know, the best thing about a mobile device is that you literally can pull it out of your pocket and quickly, send a note to your podcast conspirator and say, where are you?
Where are you? Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah,
so having the ability to do that on the go, I think, is going to be a big win.
Okay. Anything else did they do this week?
They talked some about, well, of course, they've completed the transition to be completely hosted on Office 365 now.
That's
we talked about that in our last episode,
true.
But
that's
I think
true.
That's done.
But it's only for Office 365 commercial users.
Right.
So the Outlook app, it links to Gmail, as you mentioned, and it links to other mail servers. Those guys are still based on AWS.
Right.
And also on-prem users. They're still on AWS. It's just going to take them time to get over to the new architecture.
Well, it's a big problem. Hundreds of millions of mailboxes, hundreds of millions of users. It's, you know, these
things
take time.
Well, it's more like tens of millions. For the Outlook client, I think the last number I saw was something like 20 million. Maybe it's 25 million. It fluctuates.
All right, Outlook team, get on that. We need more users.
Well, actually, one of the interesting things this week, I thought, was the fact that when we're talking about numbers, is that Microsoft did not increase the public number that they report for monthly active users for Office 365. Last May, they came out with a number, and they said it was 70 million.
Interesting.
Last July, when they briefed the financial analysts, they said it was 70 million. And Scott Guthrie, when he got up during the keynote on Monday, he said 70 million.
Interesting. That almost sounds like you might write a column about that.
I might write a column. Well, yeah. No, I'm not into shooting fish in a barrel. You know, I don't understand this. It seems that they're still on course to get to the 20 billion annualized revenue run rate for commercial cloud products, which include Azure, include Office 365, by mid 2018.
But to get that
from the point they were at in July, they would have to be adding $1 billion of revenue per quarter for these products. And you'd imagine that there'd be a few Office 365 users added to the mix.
Well,
so I don't understand why they didn't increase it.
They bought LinkedIn. I'm sure they're going to recognize a huge amount of revenue from that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously,
I'm just curious about the numbers.
It will be interesting
to see.
I just
watched
those
numbers, and I'm just curious. But shifting gears a little, you live in America. I don't. So you have the benefit of automatic calendar entries created from email notifications,
yes,
like Southwest flight tickets and stuff like that, bookings. Do you think this is useful or not? I can't make my mind out.
I think it's useful to a certain segment of people. You know, I'm like you. I'm a fairly heavy traveler. I already use TripIt to organize my trip bookings and keep track of them using their mobile app and so on. So having my email system recognize that something is a flight confirmation and offer to add it to the calendar, it's a nice party trick, but I already have a system for doing that that takes into account things like when I'm supposed to pick up my rental car and when hotel checkout time is and so on. And Microsoft is not proposing to do that. On the other hand, for the casual traveler, for people who don't use TripIt, or for people who are surprised and delighted to find that now this
users
flight
of Outlook.com.
Also true. I think it's a good example of the kind of contextual awareness that Microsoft excels at. And I had a long conversation with Jeff Mieliff, whom I believe you know, last night about the differences in contextual awareness between Microsoft's Cortana, Apple's Siri, and Google's Google Now, or whatever they call it. And one of the one of the things about Cortana that people who have not used that system don't realize is how much back-end contextual intelligence is built in thanks to the Bing services. That's why if you ask all three of those services who the Saints play this weekend, Siri will come back and say, I found such and such on the web. Cortana will come back and tell you that the Saints game is at 4 p.m. Sunday in New Orleans or whatever. And if they're able to extend that, one of the most important, one of the richest sources that they have is the ability to look at your email, calendar, and contact data. Now, we all know it's well established that Google does that, and they do it for a variety of reasons, many of which people don't like when they understand them. I'm not making a value
advertising.
Judgment.
Advertising, advertising, advertising.
And advertising.
And advertising.
You know, don't want to leave that out.
No, no.
Microsoft is taking a slightly different approach, as is Apple. They want to mine the data. Apple is mining data from the local device, which is an interesting approach because then there's nothing in the cloud, there's nothing to subpoena. It's all data that you own and control access to. But it also limits what intelligence they have. So when I get in my car and my phone detects that I've paired to the car Bluetooth, it will usually offer driving directions and a time estimate for where it thinks I'm going. But it doesn't know where I'm going because it doesn't see my calendar. So unless I put an entry on my calendar that says I'm going to my girlfriend's house for dinner, or I'm going to the gym, or I'm going to Ignite, it doesn't know. Microsoft has the potential to know that by extracting that data from 365 or from Outlook.com. So I'm not excited about the automatic flight discovery feature just because that's a use case that I already have covered. But when I look at the broad potential of other things they could do, there's a lot of very exciting stuff that they could be doing with that in the future.
Well, for the people who aren't excited by like you are, you can turn it off. The good news is there is a PowerShell commandlet to do it. Set mailbox, calendar, configuration, events off, or something like that. It's documented online. Let's talk a little bit about some joined up thinking that's happening inside Office 365.
Okay.
And it's taken a while because, you know, the service went live in June 2011.
Right.
We're now some 63, 64 months later on. And eventually, everybody has started to play nice together when it comes to compliance. I heard a couple of really big pieces of news this week at Ignite, which I thought were absolutely indicative of this kind of thinking. The first is, let me try this one on you.
Okay.
You know about retention policies?
Yes.
Okay, and they work for? What workload do they work for?
What workload?
Yeah, Exchange.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I thought this was a trick question.
No, it's no trick question.
Okay.
It works for Exchange.
So they work for Exchange, and there are other mechanisms for
their
workloads.
And they have one action, two actions, one action. It's basically move or delete,
right?
So they're pretty simple, right? SharePoint, you have...
Oh, Lord, I don't even know.
Yeah, you have preservation policy. But the point is that there are two different policies.
Yes.
Right? So a really interesting session yesterday about data governance. Data governance, I'll say that right, show that Microsoft is actually taking a very different approach to this now. They plan to roll this out late this year, maybe early next year, where they're going to be basically replacing all of the compliance kind of retention policies that exist in SharePoint and Exchange and replacing them with what they're calling classification policies that apply across all of Office 365.
Interesting.
Exchange, SharePoint, Skype, Yammer, the lot, everything. Now, apart from this party trick, which is good in terms of being able to cover all of the data sources, it's also going to be it's an extended platform, extensible platform. So where you've got now you've got actions to say, I want to keep something, so I'll archive it, or I want to delete something, so I'll delete it.
Right.
Now you'll be able to say, I want to classify something, and I want to classify it in such a way that it stamps a label on it. Or it applies something like a rights management template, because I know that this is an important document that I need to
keep. This is building on the FCI stuff that the Windows Server folks have been working on
for
a while.
Building on other components as well. Two specific ones, DLP.
Right.
DLP brings sensitive data types to the party. So you can take some data, sensitive data types, and say, well, by the way, I'll create a query for this policy,
right,
so that only this policy will only actually influence documents or messages that have this specific data type in it. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the Azure Information Protection, which allows users to apply labels as part of the whole creation process. And once they apply labels, it brings in a whole range of stamping of things like a watermark on documents,
right,
you know, so you can have top secret put on everything, or indeed the application of a rights management template. So I guess for the first time what I'm seeing here is joined up thinking around the whole management of data. Gosh knows there's enough data going in through Office 365 now. Another thing that was said the other day was multiple petabytes of data have now been imported through the Office 365 import service. Multiple petabytes have come in. I hope those are PST files. I hope they're PST files and we're getting
rid of
them.
I hope they're PST files and it's a one-way trip.
Oh, it is a one-way trip. Well, you see, this is one I think Office 365, it's the value prop that they're trying to put on the table. They're saying, move your data once.
Right.
All these PSTs, file servers, legacy mail archives, move them all. Get them to Office 365. They stay in Office 365. It's a consistent repository that can be managed with a common set of tools, and the data never has to move again.
As long as you want to keep it there, it never has to move
again. As long as you want to keep it
there. Now, let's talk about one more area of moving data in the short time we have remaining.
Right.
Public folders.
Yuck.
Well,
yep.
They are a fact of life.
They are a fact of life.
They are a thing that happens, and sometimes people, you know, are forced into compromising actions because of them. So Microsoft is trying to kill the whales. Right,
yep. the big public folder hierarchies.
They're trying to find the largest public folder hierarchies that are out there and help their customers hoover all that data into the cloud. Let's talk about that.
Right, well, so the Exchange Group, who's responsible for all of this, has put out a call for action, if you will, to say, look, if you're a customer with a big public folder hierarchy, so something like 50,000 folders, up to 100,000 folders are larger, they'd like to hear from you, because what they want to do is figure out how to get these guys across to Office 365.
So you know what I'm picturing is when they say they'd like to hear from those customers, I picture somebody wearing like a welding mask and big rubber gloves, looking at the keyboard with some trepidation as they get ready to open those messages.
No, I think what they're looking for is just some customers that they can try out some techniques with early in a preview process to figure out, you know, do they have tools that are effective, fast and efficient? Because the problem that you have with public folder migration right now, at least in the tools that are available for Microsoft, is that the process is intensely manual.
Right.
I mean, gosh knows it's easy enough to demonstrate if you have a public folder hierarchy with 100 folders and you get a CSV file with 100 folders and you figure out, yeah, that's where they should go over to Office 365 modern public folders.
So,
but when you got 50,000, when you got 100,000, when you got 2 terabytes of information, you know, that's not.
But why hadn't Microsoft solved this by now? I mean, years ago they were telling us to move public folders into SharePoint, but they never gave us tools to do that. And then it was move to modern public folders, and we didn't really get effective tools for doing that. What's different now? Are they getting customers who are approaching them and saying, we would move to the cloud, but public folders?
Yeah, I think a lot of the easy challenges have been ticked off, and now we're into the really hard stuff. And these become blocking factors. These are the things that will stop customers finally turning off the last on-prem Exchange server. If they got public folders, turn it off.
Okay.
But the interesting thing, though, is that we're also seeing that some of the ISV community are stepping up to the mark and are producing tools that will help customers move those public folders to destinations other than public folders.
Right.
Right, so you take Binary Tree, where some of our good MVP friends are working. they have got a facility in E2E Complete, that tool,
right,
that will allow you to say, well, I've got this public folder here. It looks pretty good. It's got email traffic. It's got some documents. It's got a calendar type of stuff. I'll move that over as part of a regular migration project. So that's one approach. Another approach is taken in a product that was launched here at Ignite this week in Quadratech's Atom.
Right.
Technology. ADAM stands for Advanced Data Analytics and Management. But essentially for public folders, what it means is, give me your hierarchy, let me suck it up, let me put it through an analytics engine, let me figure out what kind of data, what kind of characteristics of data exist inside your public folders, i.e. what's rubbish and should be deleted, what's legacy and should be archived, what's active and should be maintained. And then for the active, what's the valid destinations that I have? It could be that some public folders should go to a shared mailbox. They shouldn't go near a public folder ever again.
They could all go into PSTs, right?
Don't say that word. Don't say that word. That's offensive. So they could go to shared mailboxes.
Okay.
But they might also go to a modern public folder in Office 365. But here's the kicker. Some of them should go to Office 365 groups.
Well, naturally.
But the nice thing is that once you decide what it is, and it's all done in as an automatic way as you can, the migration flows. And you say, go, all those public folders, bang, 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 and they end up in the destinations.
I have to say, I like the idea of having an automated tool to do that, but the thought of running it against 50,000 or 100,000 public folders and just letting it have its way, it horrifies me a little bit.
It does, but do you know who was involved in this whole project? Siggy.
Well,
Mr. All right. Public Folder himself.
If Siggy Weber was involved with this, and I can endorse it.
Siggy Jagat, an MVP from Germany, who has come to multiple events over the years to talk about how to migrate public folders, and is a consultant to some of the customers that have got the most public folders in the world. Siggy has been driving a lot of this.
If Siggy has been deeply involved in that, so that satisfies my objection.
And he's done a good job. Okay, I think we're probably going to get thrown out of the studio in a few minutes.
I'm amazed we haven't gotten thrown out before.
We're getting eyes over there. So we should complete. What do you think is going to happen? Anything in the next couple of days that's going to be startling? Or are you looking forward to it?
You know, usually at Ignite, the big announcements are in the first couple of days. So the first day is typically keynote. That's Microsoft's chance to have their prom, if you will.
Yep.
And then the second and third days are when other smaller companies have their chance to highlight their announcements. So with tomorrow being Thursday, it's sort of the tail end day. I don't really expect a lot of large news. But
I agree. I think it's all detail. But it's the detail that really counts. And exactly. We'll keep a close eye on it, and we'll let people know if we find anything else interesting. Okay, so next time in California?
Next time in California, probably another 3 months or so from now, unless something exciting happens and we have to convene another special session. So.
All right.
Oh, I almost forgot, connections.
Connections, yes, we'll be in Connections.
So we'll do another episode of Connections. We hope to see you there, if you're there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I look forward to the annual Connections event. It's a different event to something like this.
It's immensely different. It's much smaller, more intimate, more connected.
It's about a tenth of the size, maybe, or even a twentieth of the size. But the nice thing about it is it's an intimate event, and you get to see people, get to talk to people, get to recognize people, and have some really good in-depth technical conversations. So I'm looking forward to Connections in Las Vegas in 2 weeks' time. And I'll see you there.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Paul.